Welcome to the podcast of The Wildlife. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about killer whales and their vocalizations with Ari Daniel Shapiro, a wildlife biologist and radio contributor who earned his PhD studying this subject. Ari will reveal a number of interesting facts about the sounds of killer whales. For instance, did you know that they use both high and low frequencies in the same vocalization? He'll also tell us about what it's really like to undertake this demanding kind of research in remote and frigid locales. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call comes from a marine mammal species that can prey on fish, seals, and even dolphins and whales. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Ari Daniel Shapiro. While earning his PhD in biological oceanography at MIT and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Ari studied the vocalizations of killer whales. Now, he uses his own voice and knowledge to tell stories about science on radio and other media. He's a regular contributor to a variety of national public radio programs and the host of both the Podcast of Life and Ocean Gazing. When we talked recently, I asked Ari what first got him interested in killer whales.
I mean, ever since I was little, I was really interested in the outdoors and in biology. And so I think that it kind of grew out of that. So for a long time, I was interested in these things, and then I was trying to figure out kind of what I wanted to do with it, and so I took a biology class in high school that was fantastic. My AP biology teacher was, still one of my favorite teachers and I kind of thought that that's what I would study going into college. And so I majored in biology. I thought I might major in English too, but I only ended up majoring in biology and doing some math too. And then I was trying to figure out, what I wanted to do after I graduated, and I was trying to spend the summers, figuring that out. And really, in the summer after my junior year of college, I did an internship at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in the lab that would eventually become the lab I did my PhD in. And I worked on a project with a grad student at the time there on killer whales up in the Pacific, up in Canada, near Vancouver Island. These data had been collected by this grad student, and he recorded fish-eating killer whales. These are called resident killer whales off of Vancouver Island. Okay. And so I was analyzing their vocalizations and found that, unlike other projects that I'd tried before, this one I was staying very interested in for a long period of time. I found that I was getting I found my interest wandering with other projects. But with this one, I was just fixated on it, really loved it. And it was kind of that got me interested in kind of the realm of animal behavior and animal communication. So, there were a couple of other things leading up to that convinced me that that's what I wanted to do. But that was sort of a main event for me.
So what did you find so fascinating about this project?
Well, I think it was the vocalizations were just beautiful. I mean, they have both a low component and a high component, low frequency component and a high frequency component, and the whales produce both components simultaneously in a particular call. And when you look at these calls on a spectrogram, that's the visual way of representing a sound, they looked like waterfalls to me. I mean, they just were so beautiful to look at and to listen to. So there was something about that really interested me. And then, of course, you hear these animals vocalizing, and I just wondered, why were they doing it? What was the reason behind it? What could they possibly be doing it for? And that kind of curiosity, I guess, really propelled me. The data had been collected in a way that in which the They were collected using an array, so it was these hydrophones, which are underwater microphones, kind of spaced apart in a line. And so it was possible to isolate who was vocalizing in the horizontal, so it was possible to tell often one individual apart from the group. So part of what I became interested in was how these animals were interacting, not just that they were calling, but what were the patterns of interaction and who was doing the vocalizing. And using this array technology, it was possible to begin to tease that apart. So also that summer, I got involved with doing an analysis that looked at that and found that eventually we kind of found that these animals seemed to be counter-calling with one another and matching those calls. So different animals would reply to one another and produce the same calls within their repertoire. So that just kind of gave it this extra life, you know, in terms of how they were signaling each other that, you know, just hearing the sequence alone wouldn't necessarily have. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, I was interested in, you're saying there's both high frequencies and low frequencies in the same vocalization.
Right.
And is that unusual to, or unique to whales?
Well, it's characteristic of killer whales. I'm trying to think I'm not sure of other species that we see it with. I wouldn't be able to say definitively, but most of the other whales that I'm thinking of, you know, they don't have that particular feature. So yeah, I think it's something that's fairly distinctive for the killer whales.
Now, for your dissertation, you were studying Norwegian killer whales.
Right.
And what is there something special about Norwegian killer whales?
Well, every population of killer whales feeds on, they kind of have their own vocal repertoire, and they tend to have their own feeding behavior, their own feeding style, different diets and things. So in Norway, for example, these killer whales feed on herring, and they do it in groups, and they corral the herring. You know, the herring, at least the times when humans have studied the killer whales, which is during the daytime, the herring go down to depth. They go down deep when it's the daytime because that means that they're able to avoid visual predators if they're down deep where it's dark. And then at nighttime, they come up. But when people study them, it's daytime and the fish are down deep. And the killer whales, as a group, go down and gather up the herring, kind of siphon them off from, they'll siphon off a smaller school from the larger mass of fish down at depth and pull them up to the surface, corralling them the whole way, circling around them, and then they tail slap the edge of the ball of fish that they've herded and incapacitate the fish and then eat them off one by one. And that's very unique. I mean, there are other populations of killer whales do things very differently. The ones that I was just talking about up in Canada, I mean, there are a couple of different types up there, but there's one group that eats salmon. Those are the resident fish-eating ones that I was talking about. There are also ones that eat marine mammals. Other killer whales in other parts of the world feed on other things, you know, turtles or other sorts of fish and things. So these populations, you know, they're all part of the same species, but they do have these very distinct feeding and vocal behavioral differences.
So the feeding behavior you were just talking about, is that what's known as carousel feeding?
Yes.
And then within that, do individual whales have specific roles in that process, or is it so the group just circles around the herring deep and drives, I guess, can you describe it more? It sounds very interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was one of the things I was interested in looking at, to see whether these whales had particular roles, but I didn't find any strong evidence for that, so it's hard to say whether they do, but yeah, I mean, these killer whales in Norway, like in many other locations, they move around in family groups, and so they're...
How big are these groups?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the exact numbers, but I do know that they ranged in size. But you'd get a collection of animals, maybe, you know, 5, 6, 7 animals, and they could be bigger. You know, sometimes you're with groups that were larger, 15, 20 animals. But sometimes you get large accumulations of animals in a particular area. You know, you'd have dozens of animals that would somehow converge on a particular area. But then when they would move off, they would again kind of fragment into these family groupings. So you'd have these groups that would feed, and again, they would, before we started the study, the kind of pattern of behavior that I just described was pretty much what was thought to be the way in which the animals fed up there. So they'd go down to depth, bring some fish up, corral them at the surface, and then tighten the ball, slap it, and eat them one by one. And they were very vocally active during this period.
So when you say corralling the fish, they were basically circling the herring?
Yeah, that's right. So they circle the fish, they flash their white underbellies, and they blow bubbles as well. And all of these things, you know, again, if the fish are sensitive to light, then perhaps the light underbellies might make them try to avoid that. And also, they don't think they really like the bubbles so much. So these were ways that the killer whales, these were things the killer whales would do to kind of gather the fish up into a tighter and tighter ball.
And how did they subdue them or incapacitate them?
So the animals work in a group. If all the animals decided to tail flap simultaneously, then the ball would disband. But you have enough animals that are still going around in circles around the ball to keep it intact. And then animals would take turns, and they would come at the ball and just swipe their tail through the ball. So they would do almost like a vertical cartwheel and take the tail, slice it through the ball of fish, incapacitating the fish, and then eating them one by one after that. So there was a level of coordination that was obvious, but how they were doing it and whether there was any pattern in that coordination wasn't clear.
So then what kind of work were you doing?
So the kind of work that I was doing, we were using these digital archival tags. They're called D-tags. They were developed in Woods Hole at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution by two people. One is an engineer there. His name is Mark Johnson. And my advisor, Peter Tyak, who's in the biology department. And the two of them kind of worked together to develop these tags that attach to free-ranging whales and dolphins, and well, mostly whales. And they have the suction cups so that they mount on the whales with these suction cups. So they're non-invasive in the sense that they don't puncture the skin at all. They're all on the surface. And the tags record the movements, the 3D movements of the animal, and the vocalizations of the animal and anything in its environment. So they're sampling at a really, really high rate, which means that the tags have to come back to us in order for us to offload the data, because otherwise you can't beam it off like a satellite. It's not like a single GPS position or something. There's so much data that you have to get the tags back. So at a particular predetermined time, the tags release from the animal, and then we would go and recover the tags.
So they have a transponder or something so you can find these tags?
Yeah, so they've got a VHF beacon on them, so it stands for very high frequency, and we would use a kind of tracking system in order to chase down the tags.
And how do you attach them to the animals?
With a 7-meter long pole, and usually, and then someone with a lot of upper body strength. We had two vessels that we were using in Norway. One was a sailboat that was, we weren't sailing it. It was under motor the whole time. And that was kind of our observation vessel. We used a boat called the Isle Air. And then we also had a small rigid hull inflatable boat that we would use to kind of cruise around the fjords. So we were in northern Norway, close to the Lofoten Islands, and we were in Vestfjord and Ofotfjord and Tusfjord. Tusfjord was the place where we spent most of our time.
And what time of year were you studying the whales?
We were there in November. So, and the reason for that is that's when the herring, at least they used to, the herring would come into the more protected fjords, and it was a lot easier to study them during that time of year than any other time.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, so the whales would come in. We'd go there in November, and then we had the sailboat, and then we had this rigid hull inflatable, and it was from that smaller kind of Zodiac, that rubber boat, that we would do the tagging. And we had a couple of folks that were helping us do that, but really it does require a lot of upper body strength because we used a 7-meter long carbon fiber pole. So the pole itself was very light, but you hold one end of it, and at the other end, this tag is attached. And you have to wait for the whale to come up in the right location. And that's a combination of good luck and knowing the animals and the driver of the boat. So you had someone else on the boat who was driving, moving in very closely and very gradually and gently to the animals. And everyone, you know, all the drivers have different strategies, the taggers have different strategies, but as the killer whales would surface, you'd kind of, and they would go down, the killer whales would dive for maybe, say, 10 minutes at a time. They'd come up for several breaths in a row, and it was about trying to match the speed of the animals and kind of predict where they might come up. So when they did come up, there wasn't such a long distance that you'd have to traverse with the boat to get from where you last spotted them to where they currently came up. So then once the animal was close enough, and since it's a 7-meter long pole, you kind of have to get more or less within 7 meters, and then, you know, you kind of, the tagger would lower the tag out and then essentially push the tag onto the whale, pull back on the pole, and that would release the tag onto the animal because it would stick with the suction cups. So you have to hold the pole, though, out in horizontally, and you're holding one end of it. So the torque on that pole is really intense, and that's what requires all that body strength. So, and then once the tag would go on, it would stay on for, you know, we had tags, they were short deployments because it was November, we were just north of the Arctic Circle, so we didn't have a lot of daylight to play with. So the tags would go on for anywhere from, say, a little less than 2 hours to maybe 4 or 5 hours. So they were short deployments. But then once they're on, you know, they dive with the animal, and it's like you're sitting on the whale and riding with it at depth and seeing how it's moving and rolling and pitching and how deep it is and how it's vocalizing and how group members are. Mostly it was how the group was vocalizing. It was hard to tell the individual animal and the tagged animal whether it was them that was vocalizing.
So the tag picks up all the sounds around it as well as that particular individual.
Yeah, it's like wearing a microphone.
Oh, interesting, interesting. So I take it you don't get seasick then?
Well, I do. Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I got seasick. The second Sapil season we went, I did this in 2005 and 2006. And in 2006,
so you're a glutton for a punishment then.
Well, in 2005 I was okay. Mostly I was okay. But then in 2006, I mean, it's such a great team of people that it was in a beautiful surroundings. I mean, it was just spectacular. I mean, there were times when I felt like it was on another planet, you know. I mean, it's just exquisitely beautiful. But in 2006, the herring began moving. They stopped coming as far into the fjords in 2006. And by now, I mean, they hardly ever come into these protected fjords. And I guess it's in November. And my understanding is that this is something that happens every kind of 20 years or so. The herring kind of occupy a different location, and they come into the fjords for 20 years, and then they leave, and they stay offshore for 20 years during November. So,
really, why does anybody know why that is?
No, I mean, they must be. I don't know. I mean, maybe they're following their own food source. We don't know.
Interesting.
So, and you know, and there are a lot of people that depend on herring either as fishermen or that depend on the killer whales as whale watchers or scientists or something that counted on them coming into the fjords. And then it just stopped. In 06, that was kind of the beginning of it. And we hardly got any animals coming into the fjords. And so we spent a lot of days just kind of looking for them and doing some other experiments and waiting. And then finally, I think it was after a couple of weeks, we finally got a sighting of the killer whales, and they were they were in Vestfjord, and Vestfjord's actually open to the North Sea. Like it's long and narrow, but the waves are more intense. Tufjord is more protected, which is why we like to stay there. But you know, we were going to take what we could get. So the killer whales were spotted in Vestfjord. We went out there, we deployed the tag boat, and we went for it, and we ended up getting a tag on, which was great. But I was below deck and trying to get the tags ready. I had gotten used to the fact that we wouldn't see them, so I didn't have the tags ready. So when we heard that we had the whales, I went down and got the tags all ready, but I was below deck. The waves were pushing us around. There weren't any windows, so I was doing minute detail work below deck and getting tossed around. And finally, I got the thing. I got the tag ready. And then there was one other thing I had to plug in, and I was starting to feel really queasy, and I just said, all right, I got to plug this thing in. So I plugged the thing in, and then I just couldn't hang on. I ran upstairs and heaved over the deck. So I did get sick that second field season.
Yeah, not surprising in the conditions.
Yeah.
No, but, and you know, how did you prevent your presence from affecting the whale's natural behavior?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, often with these studies, so there have been a variety of species that have been tagged by different groups using these D-tags. And generally, kind of the first dive is often kind of dismissed or ignored because it could be anomalous or something, if it looks anomalous. But we didn't see any behavior with the animals that we tagged, except for, you know, they'll flinch generally. But after that, they just return to normal. I mean, from what we couldn't detect any differences mm-hmm. at the surface visually. And then when you look at the tag, we didn't really see any differences either. Would then dive really deep, or they would go on a very long dive or start vocalizing a bunch. It seemed like they pretty much stayed consistent with their previous behavior. Now, that's not to say that we may have been disturbing them, but at least from what we saw, it didn't look like we were. And then once the tag went on, then the boats fell back. So then we really stayed at a good distance from the animals. Well, we could still stay close enough so we could observe what was going on, but we fell back so that we weren't right on top of them anymore and gave them the sort of distance that they'd be used to anyway.
Tell me more about the main purpose of the research.
Well, I guess, knowing that there was this kind of coordination going on at the group level to feed, that was one thing I was interested in. So trying to understand more about that, as you had asked before, Laurel, were any of the animals exhibiting particular roles in the behavior? I was interested in that. I just kind of wanted to get a sense of how the animals may have been working together. I was interested in trying to tag two animals at the same time to see whether there was any sort of interaction. Just trying to kind of get the basic understanding of that.
What did you find?
I mentioned this, the general sequence of behavior that we had considered to be kind of how killer whales feed up there before.
Right.
Now, the tags, because they're on the whales at all times, part of that view was somewhat colored. The previous view was colored by visual observations. There was also, which all happened at the surface, there was some sonar work that was done at depth, but you still don't have, it's hard to track individual animals. So once we had these tags on individual animals, we could observe, we found a second kind of foraging strategy. And that
oh, really?
Involved, yeah. So we tagged one male in the first field season, and he showed it the strongest. But so as I said, these animals are very vocal when they're feeding, and even when they're going down to corral the fish. That we found from the tags. But there was this other behavior where the animal, this male, was traveling more or less to the southwest. And as he traveled to the south, he was completely quiet. You know, he traveled south, then he traveled west for a bit, south and west. And then after a couple of hours, he made this hairpin turn. He was heading south and just did a complete 180 and started traveling north. And traveled north for a while, and then all of a sudden began tail flapping and vocalizing and apparently feeding. I mean, we were using the tail flapping as a proxy for feeding because you can see on the movement record of the animal when it was going through one of those vertical cartwheels, so it was possible to diagnose when the tail flap corresponded to the tagged animal. So it seemed that, because I observed this with a couple of other animals, it seemed that sometimes the animals may be potentially, I mean, it's hard to say for sure, but this was consistent with what we saw. They might be eavesdropping on what's going on around them. I mean, feeding is very noisy. Their animals are vocalizing, they're tail flapping. It's just loud. And so if the animals are just kind of traveling along, they have excellent hearing, and they probably hear this stuff going on in their environment. And the fact that this male did that really dramatic turn and went north then to converge with this other group of feeding animals, and then his group started feeding, suggests that maybe there's this sort of other ninja-like approach. To,
oh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, all of this is, you know, we've got such small sample sizes. It takes such effort to get a tag on a single animal. And because of the change in the location of these animals from one year to the next, you know, we still ended up tagging, you know, 14, 15 animals, but it, you know, it's still just to find anything conclusive, you know, you really need to stay at it for a long period of time. So anyway, these are just kind of glimpses. But you asked kind of what the point of the research was, and there was one other thing I could talk about, and that is their vocal behavior. And one of the things that really intrigued me about the Norwegian killer whales is that they produce these things called compound calls, which are series of calls that happen in rapid sequence, and you see the same sequence of calls over and over again.
What do you mean? Can you give me an example?
So it might sound like something like that, and you hear that sequence of three, 1, 2, 3, over and over again. And this had been documented by another researcher, Hannes Stager, in the early 90s. And so I was very interested in that and wondering what the patterns of that were. I wondered, based on my early work with the killer whales, the ones off of in Canada, whether this was an instance of countercalling, so it was one animal beginning, another animal following, and the first animal replying, like birds, songbirds will duet like that, or if it was one animal producing those calls. And I was just kind of interested in the structure of the calls in general. So that was something else that made me want to study them in Norway. So one of the other analyses that I did was looking at the sequences and ordering of these particular calls, and whether there were segments inside those calls that were conserved across so killer whales produce these stereotyped calls, and I was interested in looking at whether they were conserving shorter segments within these stereotyped calls across the calls, so almost like phonemes in human speech that are used in lots of different words. Were these killer whales using conserved segments across multiple calls? Not that the calls had meanings, linguistic meanings or word meanings like our words do, but just these were vocalizations, and I was just wondering kind of what was generating that vocal material.
That's really interesting. How does that compare to if you were studying that in humans? You said it wouldn't, for humans, it would correspond to different words or different parts of words?
So I guess the equivalent would be segments, would be like phonemes in human speech. So I was looking for kind of basic elements. When I make this analogy to human speech, it's important that I'm not drawing a connection between the killer whales having anything resembling a language or anything resembling human speech. I'm just using this as a metaphor for the different vocal pieces, because it does not seem that a particular call means fish or turn right or even that they have vocal labels for one another. It just seems that they have these repertoires. And what the repertoires are being used for, we don't really know that yet. But having said that, the different segments within these calls, so they have these call types, and the call types are stereotypes. So we see them repeat, we see them over and over again, produced by different animals. And it's likely then that those calls, so those calls, I would draw the connection then with our, words, because they're these things that we hear multiple people say, and we hear them over and over in different contexts. But again, the killer whales don't have words. It's just that would be the unit that I would be thinking of. And then within our words, we have phonemes. So in the word bat and the word cat, the a sound is conserved. And then I was looking for similar conserved sounds in killer whales. And I found a bunch. I found a bunch of these segments, and that were conserved across calls among Norwegian stereotype calls. There were certain of these segments that I also found in so-called variable calls, which until this point have been kind of considered like a catch-all garbage pail category. It's like, well, they don't fit under any other main heading, so we just call them variable. But it turns out that it seems that some of these segments actually appear in variable calls. And then there were a much smaller grouping that showed up, these segments that showed up in the calls of Canadian animals. So there may be some sharing across populations.
So are there different sort of dialects or similarities between the vocalizations of one group of whales and another group?
There are definitely differences, and you can tell different populations apart for sure based on the vocal repertoire of the different groups. You can tell groups apart as well. In fact, much of the group-level distinctions that have been documented in the Pacific North, well, in the Canadian waters off of Vancouver Island, are a result of the acoustic similarities. So you have something called an acoustic clan, and that's a kind of grouping based on any animals that share a common acoustic call, So that's a pretty big group. And then you get down to finer and finer overlaps until you're essentially looking at a matriline, so a mother and all of her offspring. So you can tell the level of social connection between animals based on how much of their vocal repertoire overlaps. Now, in terms of similarities between populations, there's only so many combinations of sounds. So they might sound.
I was going to ask you, how many sounds does a killer whale make?
it's a good question. They make lots and lots of sounds, but they all exist kind of within the same general. I mean, they exist within the same frequency range and the same time duration. But generally, these repertoires are distinct across populations.
And are the calls associated with any specific activities, or is it still too early to tell?
It seems too early to tell. There have been different hypotheses that have been put forward for why these calls are being used. And when I'm talking about the calls, these are frequency-modulated calls, you know, that last a while. I'm not talking about the echolocation clicks.
Mm-hmm.
These, you know, staccato bursts of sound. It's almost like a sonic strobe light that the animals use to probe their surroundings. So in terms of a possible function, so one idea is that these animals use the calls to help figure out where one another are. And that could happen in a variety of ways. So one way is just that if these animals are vocalizing, you hear your associates and you kind of know who's around. And my guess is that's probably one of the things that's happening with the Norwegian animals. It's like if you're going to go play a sporting event, like if you go play soccer, and you look out at the field and you see all of your teammates wearing the same jersey, you know instantly where everybody is.
Right.
And my guess is that with these killer whales all vocalizing, they probably are keeping track of one another doing that. But it goes beyond that because, as I said, these killer whales have both a low frequency component and a high frequency component. The low frequency component moves away from the animal, radiates out from the animal uniformly, spherically, whereas the high frequency component tends to get beamed forward of the animal.
Really?
So yeah.
Moves this, that those sounds move differently.
That's right. They radiate from the animal differently. So if you're in front of the animal, you would hear both the low and high frequency components in roughly the same level. But if you're behind the animal, the high frequency component is much quieter. And if you're further back from the animal, you might not hear it at all. If you're to the side, you'd get some blend of that. So it's possible that these animals are using the relative differences in low and high frequency component level to tell the orientation.
Sort of like an owl does, right?
Right, yeah. So that's right. Owls are localizing in the horizontal and the vertical using the skull and the ear shape and stuff. Except that is kind of a passive listening. This is both that, because the animals are listening, as you say, but they're also producing calls that have a spectral frequency structure that could lend itself to facilitate that even more.
Wow.
So that's kind of that's been one idea that's been put forward. And when you record these animals in the wild, you see these differences in relative levels between the components. The other thing that I found very tentative evidence for. So I found a trend where I looked at calls that were used during a tail flapping situation, which usually meant they were feeding, and calls that were used during a not tail flapping situation. And I predicted that during the tail flapping situation, with the animals moving around a bunch and needing to know each other's whereabouts, there'd be more calls where you'd expect to see both low and high frequency components being used. Whereas during the not tail flapping, maybe that's not as important. And since there are calls that don't have both low and high, and they sometimes just have low or sometimes just high, maybe they would, you know, use less of the low high combo calls. And I found that there was a trend in that direction. So anyway, it's not showing a specific call type means a specific thing or used in a specific context, but it does show that, you know, these calls, the structure of these calls may be used to help the animals out when they're engaging in certain behaviors.
In coming up with those types of hypotheses, to test, did you look at other animals or research on other animals? And one of the reasons I ask is because I noticed in your acknowledgments in your dissertation, you thanked one of the librarians or staff who brought you special books about Tungera frogs. Maybe I pronounced that wrong, but I was very curious what these frogs had to do with whales.
That's a great question. So I suppose I should say that I did a master's degree in animal behavior at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And there, the focus was very much a comparative one. I think there's a lot to learn from looking at other species. And in terms of the questions that I was asking, I certainly looked to other animal models to look at cooperative feeding, in terms of how, say, lions hunt or humpback whales feed. And looking at vocal structure and sequence, songbirds come into play a lot because that's where most of the work has been done. So I certainly look to those other animal models to understand the killer whale system.
I'm wondering how you hooked up with the research team that you were working with and sort of what was your daily routine?
Well, it was a great, great collection of people, and they kind of came from a variety of different places. But we had, I'd say, probably 8 to 10 people that were working on our team. And one of the folks in our group was on my committee and actually was the person who I had done that initial work for when I was in Woods Hole. He was the student who then graduated, got his PhD, and then ended up on my committee. So he was one of them. And he was from the U.S. Then we had a couple of people that came from Scandinavia. So we had our tagger, the person who drove the tagging boat the first year was a delightful man named Mass. He's from Denmark. And he's the kind of person who's just very good at all sorts of things. And he was a counselor in Denmark for many years. And then I forget how he got connected to another tagging project, but Mark Johnson, the lead engineer on the tag, said, Mass is a great guy. You should include him on your field team. So, because they met tagging sperm whales off of Andenes in Norway. So I contacted Mass, and he said he was interested. So Mass came along. In that first field season in 2005, I worked with one of the mainstays of killer whale research who'd been up there for years, named Tiu Simola. She was from Finland and was a delightful, delightful human being. I mean, she just connected with people so easily and had a strong connection to the animals and the natural surroundings. And then she was tied to a couple of other Finnish graduate students that joined us. Tiu also knew a fella who was living in Ireland, though from England originally, who was our skipper named Jeff McGee, who was a complete trip, and he played guitar and he wrote a song about our field experience that first year.
Which oh, really?
Yeah, the refrain was the place where the sun don't shine.
If you want to hear part of that song and see the research in action, go to aridanielshapiro.com, go to videos, and find the one on orchestration.
I narrate a bit, but then Jeff's song comes up at the end, so you can hear it.
And were there other team members?
One of my committee members' students, she was also on board. So it was just kind of an eclectic bunch of people. And then we would occasionally have visitors, you know, come for a few days or something. And then the next year was a slightly different assortment of people.
And tell me about your daily routine.
Generally, so we stayed in these cabins on shore, and we went shopping in town, and then we would cook food for ourselves. So we'd wake up in the morning, but it was still dark out, you know, when we would get up. Generally, and we'd come downstairs. We had one of these artificial sun lamps, you know, that would provide.
How much sunlight was there when you were there?
Well, we got about 6 or 7 hours.
It's not real strong light.
Well, it's the light kind of comes in at a really low angle, so there's not a lot of it. It's not, as you say, it's not that strong. But what it is it's gorgeous. You know, it would light the tops of the mountains up there. They looked sherbet colored, this pinkish. When it was light, it was breathtaking. Huh. So, but it was often dark. And we did see the northern lights on a couple of occasions, which were spectacular. So we'd start the day by having breakfast, getting ready, kind of talking about the day ahead, or just hanging out, socializing mostly. And then we would put on our survival suits and get all suited up, and then we go marching down to the dock, and usually the boats were kind of put in one right next to the other, so you'd have to crawl from boat to boat to get to the Isle Air, which is our sailboat that we would take out. And then we'd motor out offshore and head out and start looking for whales and coordinate with the whale watchers and the fishing boats to try to find them. And then once we found them, we'd just start trying to tag, you know, once we kind of figured out who was in the area. And then once the tags went on, if they went on, we would follow the animals until they came off, recover the tag, and then come back in the evening. And on a night where we did get the tag data, then we would offload that data and check to make sure that it was okay. And then as long as it was okay, we'd clear the tag and recharge it so that it could be deployed the following day. And then we would crash in the evenings. And it was, and I especially that first field season, I mean, I just felt like I would close my eyes and then I would just wake up again in the morning. You know, it was like, it was just fudded. My eyes just fudded shut. And then, yeah, it was just, they were long days. And, you know, you're out there in the cold. And so.
And how cold was it?
I mean, it was, well, I mean, it was freezing, you know, and the winds were, the waters were still, I mean, we weren't frozen in, but the air temperature, I think, was, yeah, I mean, it was below freezing. It was snowing. So, and then there was sometimes a lot of wind blowing around. So, but then, you know, we had in the belly of the Isle Air, we had, there was a stove, and so we would make soup and make sandwiches too. And so it was, you know, we ate very well. And it's funny, like when you're in the field, you don't think, I don't know, I was just like, I would eat so much chocolate. Of course, the chocolate up there is incredible. This milk chocolate was just, I mean, the best chocolate I've ever tasted in
really?
My life. It's from Norway. And maybe it's just because of my positive associations with being in the field. But I would just eat, you know, like half a huge bar. I never eat that much chocolate. But in the field, it's kind of like, well, it's cold out, so I better be eating this because it's going to make me warmer. I don't know. None of it made any sense in retrospect, but at the time, it made perfect sense.
But it's everything always tastes better when you're like camping or when you're outside.
Exactly.
What was some of your funniest adventures?
Well, I mean, I can tell you about this particular dream that I had once that when I was there. You know, so I went to bed one night, and it was early on in the first field season, and I had this dream that we went to go tag a whale. We got very close to the animal, put the tag on, but when we attached it, the tag fell apart. It was like we applied too much force, and it just broke apart into all these pieces, and the whale that we were trying to tag spy hopped, so that means it comes up out of the water vertically just to poke its head above the water and looked at us. I remember being really struck by that image. And then the next day, we were out in the water, and I was on the tag boat.
So the first part was your dream, and now this is real life.
That's right. First part was the dream. Then the second part, we actually were out on the water going out the next day, and we approached an animal, and there was, you know, we were getting close to tag, and then all of a sudden, the animal did, I mean, we didn't break the tag apart, but the animal did the exact same thing as in my dream. It was a smaller animal, and he came up out of the water spy hopping, and he trained his eye on the boat. You know, he looked right at us, and it was, you know, almost just as curious about us as we were about him. And then he spent a moment above water, and then he dipped back below the surface.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time when you had like a sudden epiphany or some insight into the whale's communication?
I wish I could say I did, but I mean, it's so complex, and there's so much going on. You know, I mean, even, I guess, naively, I thought at the beginning of the study that by attaching these tags onto killer whales, which had never been done before, not on this particular species, the tags have been attached to other whales, I would find out something, some hidden thing, some hidden secret that no one has been able to figure out before. But the fact is, it's a very complex system that's going on. And attaching one tag to one whale in one part of its body in a group that is, you know, multiple animals, you know, it can be, let's say, a dozen animals that are moving around, and even the animal that we tag, once it dips below the surface, we're not exactly sure how it's oriented, what it's doing, who's vocalizing. There's still so much to know. And so then you get a single animal's movement profile, and you get the vocal behavior of a group, but it's still so hard to know what's going on. So, I mean, I think, to me, I think that's the beauty of science, the beauty of certainly nature and all its forms, is that it's just so complex and there's so many facets to it. And so no, I mean, I don't think, I did not, I remember having one epiphany in graduate school, and it felt like a total rush, but it wasn't connected to the killer whales.
Oh, what and was it though?
it was related to an analysis I was doing with sperm whales, but it wasn't even on the sperm. It was on the particular analysis that I had done, and it was like a math problem, you know. And I just puzzled over it for so long and so long. Then finally one day I said, "Okay, I'm going to close myself in this classroom and start putting things on the board and looking at my computer until I figure out what's going on. And I spent about an hour, and I mean, I've been thinking about it for weeks and weeks, and then I figured out what was going on, and I just, it was like a total high. It actually, the result ended up being non-significant, but the that moment was really beautiful, I thought. But I didn't have that sort of moment with the killer whales. I mean, it was always kind of neat putting a tag out, bringing it back, knowing that the tag that I was touching had, you know, moments before been touching an actual whale and moving with it to depth, you know. But no, I wouldn't say I had any sort of epiphany into there. I mean, they're mysterious animals, and I think that, you know, that my graduate work kind of helped me appreciate that even more.
I think that's one thing that I find really interesting is sort of the more you learn, the more you learn you don't know. Mm-hmm. With the D tags, those digital tags, are they used, is that technology used for other species as well?
Yeah, it's been used on a variety of species. It's been used on sperm whales, beaked whales, humpback whales, right whales. Modified version was used on harbor porpoises. It's been used on another modified version on manatees. What else has it been used on? Yeah, a variety of animals.
Now, you've also studied other whales as well. You had mentioned the sperm whales as well and other populations of killer whales. And you've also written a paper talking about narwhals. Is that right?
Correct.
Swimming upside down. And
right.
That was so curious. I just wanted to find out what was with that.
That was the first field work that I did for my PhD. And that was kind of this, I mean, it was total happenstance. I bumped into this I bumped into a scientist at a marine mammal conference in the December of my first year of graduate school, who said, you know what, you should, I mean, it was almost kind of this, he said it in almost an offhand way, but it ended up being like a formative thing for me eventually. He said, you should study narwhals. And I mentioned this to Peter, my advisor, and Peter said, oh, that's great. And he popped out this business card that a narwhal scientist had handed him at that same meeting, and he said, why don't you get in touch with Runa Dietz, who is one of the lead researchers from Denmark on this narwhal team up in Arctic Canada. And so I went up there to study these animals and put D tags on them. And at that point, you know, I didn't know, you know, it was my first time doing this work, and so I was very inexperienced. So, but we still managed to get two tags out and got the data back. And there was a National Geographic team that was up there as well. And they'd done some critter cam stuff, putting video cameras on these narwhals, and found that when the animals went to depth, they actually were upside down, traveling and swimming. And the DTAG confirmed this. I mean, the animals spent a lot of time upside down. And
why?
And, well, you know, there were a few suggested reasons, but we don't know really. I mean, it may have something to do with them trying to forage, or maybe they're trying to avoid bumping their tusk. It's not clear, though. There are other species that do it as well. So, but yeah, it was just this kind of this really interesting phenomenon. And you know, I mean, when you're underwater, upside down is the same as right side up in some ways. You know, it's all kind of equivalent. So, but yeah, that was kind of the first field work that I did. So it was nice to do a paper based on that.
And I think it's interesting that you've done all this research on into whale vocalizations, and I'm wondering if it's influenced your current career in radio.
Well, you know, I mentioned, I guess, when we first started talking about trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and you know, when I grow up, and in some ways that became a 3-decade-long quest, you know, and I knew that I've always been just completely enamored with science and the natural world and learning things. And as I was finishing the final year of my graduate work, I thought, kind of, what am I going to do next? You know, is it going to be more research? Is it going to be a postdoc? And in fact, I had been thinking about maybe doing a postdoc on researching elephant vocalizations in Africa with a scientist that was based out of the UK. And I realized that I knew that I loved the idea of going to Africa to be around elephants. That was very compelling. But the thought of doing the research, I didn't find as compelling, you know, like writing up a proposal or writing up the research papers. I wasn't finding that as alluring. And so I kind of listened to that and wondered what else could be out there, maybe. And so I took a step back and thought about what I wanted the next step to hold. And I knew I wanted to be involved in science and for it to be intellectually stimulating and maybe be creative and involved with somehow social. And so I thought, well, so even if I do research, I want it to include all of those things. And then I thought about other things that were kind of outside of that realm. And one of those things was radio. And I'm not sure exactly where the idea came from, except that, so there is this other Ari Shapiro on NPR, and sometimes I would wake up in the morning and, you know, Stephen Skeep or whomever would say, well, good morning, Ari Shapiro. And then I'd be like, well, that's weird. Or people would ask me, is that you? And I'd say, no, but who knows, maybe it could be, you know? And it, I think, so that was one reason. And also it just, I mean, I always listened to NPR, and it was kind of the theme music, you know, and the theme narrative to a lot of, sometimes I would be doing things that just, I didn't need to, stuff from graduate school that, you know, was just kind of more routine stuff, just processing data, and I would listen to a variety of NPR shows, and I love that. And so I think it was just a combination of things that made me think, well, maybe radio could be a possible outlet. And so then it turned out that, so I did my PhD jointly at MIT and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And in Woods Hole, it turns out there's one of the best radio outfits in the country there. It's Atlantic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was complete coincidence, Laurel. The place where Atlantic Public Media spends, like where their kind of office is at the radio station at WCAI in Woods Hole, that house where they are is next door to the house where I used to meet with one of my committee members every week, and I never noticed it. And then all of a sudden, I found out about it and set up a meeting with someone there, and it went well. And they were beginning a new science radio project there, where they were doing these short 60-second science minutes, where based on interviews from scientists, they would do they would kind of drop these short 60-second long stories from scientists into the interstitial moments of the broadcast. And they said, why don't you give this a try? Maybe this would be up your alley. So I got in touch with a couple of scientists that I knew in Woods Hole, and they loaned me gear. And then I, using the same audio software that I'd been using to study the whales, I started moving around human speech. And, that was the beginning of it. And I got completely addicted, and I've stayed addicted to it now. It's I've been doing this full time for a little over a year, and I've been working kind of in the realm of a year before that, and it's really been kind of one thing leading to another. But I love it. I love kind of moving from topic to topic and learning about all different kinds of science and meeting different people. So it's been a real thrill.
And you recently did a story. I think it was a podcast, The Encyclopedia of Life, or something.
That's right.
On right whales?
Yes, that's right. So actually that...
So you haven't really gotten too far away.
It's interesting. I also did a piece for NPR on killer whales that aired on Weekend Edition last year. So and I did another piece for them that was in All Things Considered about elephant seals. So I've certainly kind of stayed within the oceanic realm for a number of my pieces, but you know, I've also done stories on other sorts of topics, you know, on the acoustics of French caves, for example, or acoustics, what Bach would sound like on other planets, or you know, so I've done other things outside of that, and I'm interested in a wide variety of things. So but yeah, that Encyclopedia of Life is a new podcast that that I'm working on with the folks at Atlantic Public Media, actually in Woods Hole. And that right whale story is the first episode, and it's the story of the first time I actually ever did field work during when I was in college, just after that internship in Woods Hole, and I was studying right whales. It was like a 60-ton wake-up call.
Why was that?
Well, we nearly got crushed. And that, it's like a 5-minute podcast, but it goes into that. So, yeah, so anyway, if folks are interested, that's at eol.org/podcast. But it's every other week we have a new episode about a different marine critter or creature.
And what's the site again?
It's EOL, which stands for Encyclopedia of Life, .org/podcast.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, sure, Laurel. Thank you for listening to me blabber on for a while.
Oh, no, this was great. I hope you enjoyed those insights into killer whales and their vocalizations with Ari Daniel Shapiro, a wildlife biologist and regular contributor to a variety of National Public Radio programs and the host of both the Podcast of Life and Ocean Gazing. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. The marine mammals that make these sounds are a type of toothed whale that was the subject of today's show. That's right. Here are the sounds of a pod of killer whales. For next week's creature call, we'll move to Indonesia and Malaysia, where this great ape lives. This is what's called a long call. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Next week, I'll also talk with Michelle Desolet, Executive Director of the Orangutan Land Trust. We'll talk about the orangutan she's known and what makes these great apes so special. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnimi.com, and at laurelnimi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnimi.com. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nimi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.